This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us for our Radio Main Street across North Dakota. And today we'll start our show talking about another angle on the story of the year, the pandemic. The emergency has sparked activity on the front lines, like hospitals and nursing homes, and it has spurred research to find effective treatments and a vaccine. But that's not all. Dr. Farzad Mostashari is chair of the COVID-19 Data Challenge, a partnership with Facebook Data for Good and universities and nonprofits. The effort asks developers to create tools to mine data submitted by tens of millions of Facebook users, tracking real-time COVID-19 symptoms to identify potential pandemic hotspots for better forecasting. Dr. Mostashari spoke with Conversations on Healthcare podcast hosts Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter.
Dr. Mostashari, we welcome you back to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you.
Really, the outbreak of COVID-19 caught the world off guard, from a regional epidemic to a global pandemic. Getting reliable data on outbreaks proved to be a real challenge for public health officials around the world. And you chair the COVID-19 Symptom Data Challenge, and it's a multi-stakeholder collaborative seeking really a new approach, leveraging the power of social media to better predict the spread of coronavirus. And I think our listeners would like to know maybe three things. One, tell us about the partners in the challenge. Then also the global participation already underway using the Facebook Data for Change portal. And finally, what are the breakthroughs you're looking to find in this new real-time pandemic surveillance?
Yeah, I think it's worth reviewing what are our current data sources for being able to understand what's happening with the outbreak. And that's obviously key. We have to tailor our approach to the level of activity in every state and locality. Ideally, there would be a national strategy that would be clear, and there would be data that's clear to everybody. And in the absence of that, we're all having to make our own decisions. Do we open business? Do we go out? Do we send our kids to school or not? And for that, we need data. So what are the data that we are using? If you go to any, you know, New York Times or any other dashboard to see how do we know what's going on with COVID, well, one thing you can look at are deaths. The problem with deaths as an indicator of activity in the community is they're late. It takes weeks and now up to 45 to 60 days before an increase in COVID will show fully in terms of the deaths. So deaths are a hard outcome, but they're much delayed. The second is obviously looking at case counts. The problem with case counts is it depends on testing. And if you have different intensity of testing, if you don't have a design in your testing program, if you don't have sentinel surveillance where you're testing the same kinds of people repeatedly, then you don't get reliable information from testing. And we've seen, as you know, all sorts of debates about whether the increased case count is a function of more testing or less testing or testing different people. And then the third data source is a data source that I and others innovated about 20 years ago when I was in the New York City Health Department, which is, well, let's just look at what's happening with hospitalizations or emergency room visits. And those have been quite useful, but again, limited when people change their behaviors. When they stop going to the emergency room, right, going to the doctor, because they're afraid of getting tested, that can change our receptors, as it were. So the idea here was, and this was something that Carnegie Mellon proposed to Facebook back in March, and they stood it up beginning in April, is why don't we just ask people on a massive scale, have you had any of these symptoms in the past 24 hours? They have collected 30 million survey results. Wow. Every week, there are surveys being answered by folks in every state and territory and in 70 plus countries across the world in 55 different languages, answering the question, have you had symptoms? I think it's an incredibly promising data source, but it really hasn't been used as part of one of the main pillars of us determining what's happening with COVID in the communities. And I think it's because it hasn't been validated. So this symptom challenge is basically putting the call out to citizen scientists around the world saying, here's the data. Here is publicly available aggregated counts by county, week, or by state, by day, by country. See what you can do with it. Match it up against your understanding of what's going on, the best gold standards that we have today, and see whether this is worth giving us advanced notice compared to other sources.
Share with us a little bit about the COVID-19 map and dashboard. Is that part of this Facebook initiative or separate from this? And What are people saying when they respond?
We think that it seems to be a leading indicator for sure of hospitalizations and deaths, and tracking super closely with cases and case positivity. There's an interesting proof point that just recently looking at the wildfires in the Pacific Northwest and clearly seeing a big spike in people responding to the surveys in those states saying, yes, I'm having a higher incidence of cough, for example. And when you look at Florida in the months leading up to their big increase, where people were saying, look, it's a Florida miracle. We can reopen and there's not going to be an increase in cases. It was quite clear on the symptom surveys that there was an increase happening. I think it's promising. The other thing you asked is, well, what else can you find out from this? And one of the other things you can do with symptom surveys is you can ask other questions like, are you a healthcare worker? Are you trying to social distance as much as possible? Did you get tested? Were you able to get tested? And one of the just small observations from that was the vast majority of people who have symptoms that are quite consistent with COVID, including loss of sense of smell or taste, vast majority of them never get tested. And I think that's a particular concern if we think that, for example, contact tracing is going to be one of our tools in the toolkit to stop the chains of transmission.
You know, you've rounded up really a great crew of partners here, Catalyst Health 2.0, your old colleague in New York City, Dr. Tom Frieden's resolve to save lives, as well as the very prominent universities, Duke, University of Maryland, and the Carnegie Mellon. And I'm wondering what types of data they've already extracted or insights they've gained from the data collected so far, or are you still at early stage? I know you were just finishing up phase one, going into phase two of recruiting candidates to start looking at the data, but has there been any preliminary insights so far?
Yeah, we published some of the illustrative analyses, some of the preliminary analyses done by data scientists at Facebook and Carnegie Mellon in particular, who've done a really wonderful first cut of this. The basic findings I described, looking at the timing of increases, say in Florida compared to others, other indicators, geographically looking to see that the tight correlation between states that have high levels of activity giving those traditional metrics compared to high levels of symptom survey. The example I gave also of wildfires and smoke in the Pacific Northwest. So there's a set of analyses. If folks go to the website symptomchallenge.org under illustrative analyses, you can read those and click on it. But the data is also publicly available. You can just download a CSV file and you can do it in Excel, right? And take a look at your jurisdiction if you want to look at it by county week or if you want to look at it by state, by day. And all those folks who are more engaged than ever in data, this is an incredibly rich data source for people to play with. We haven't closed phase one yet in terms of receiving applications. I'll break it here. We are going to extend the period for people to be able to submit applications. So there'll be a little bit more extra time for people to get their analyses done and submitted.
And $5,000 for those that are selected, or
the first five? Yeah, the first five semifinalists will get $5,000. We'll present publicly, and then we will select have an additional period where we'll work with them on visualizations and so forth. And then the final grand prize winner is $50,000, and second prize would be $25,000.
Wonderful.
You know, there's a lot of tough news these days, but certainly for all of us in healthcare or public health, one difficult thing has been to hear about what seems to be a politicization of CDC, really calling into question whether this beacon of the gold standard for most of us, whether we can rely on in the way we have based on what we're reading. You worked in disease surveillance at the CDC. What's alarming you about what's going on? What's at stake? What should the public know about how important it is that the CDC scientist voice be untarnished?
Look, let me start with the good news. The good news is that there are thousands of, as you said, scientists with decades of experience who are the best in the world. And, you know, sometimes I'll go on Twitter and I'll interpret some surveillance finding or, you know, play epidemiologist. And like, I always feel like I'm not the one who should be doing this. They're people who were, you know, built in a lab to be doing this work, and yet we're not hearing from them. So the problem isn't that we don't have expertise at CDC. The problem is that their voices aren't being heard. And I think it's something that can be fixed, and I hope will be fixed.
You know, Farzad, I want to pull the thread on the conversation about trust. And clearly, Facebook has 2 billion users, but there are many who feel the data is being used for the benefit of others' profit. And I'm wondering if you could talk about the privacy risk and what Facebook is doing to ensure privacy is secured, and just sort of the message to our citizen scientists about why this is so important for people to be engaged in, and the work you're doing on the back end to ensure the safety of their information.
Yeah. So look, I can't comment on Facebook as an actor in so many other ways, but I can say that in terms of this Facebook Data for Good project, I think it is doing data for good, and I do think they're doing it in a responsible way. Let me tell you a few of the things that are relevant for the listeners. This data that we're talking about here, the symptom data, is not from scraping people's social media or anything like that. It's literally a banner ad that says, do you want to take part in this survey from Carnegie Mellon? And if they click on it, opt in, obviously voluntarily, and they're taken to a screen where there's consent basically to take part in the survey, then they leave the Facebook ecosystem, leave the platform, and go to Qualtrics where the surveys are done. Uh-huh. So it's consent is voluntary. There's no information goes back or forth other than the consented individuals plus the survey sample weights that get pushed to Carnegie Mellon University's Delphi Survey Research Group, which is a highly credible academic group. So that's, you know, in terms of where the survey comes from, it's people willingly answering questions, consented and with a high security bar in terms of the Carnegie Mellon site. The second part of it is, well, who has access to that information? And the information that we're putting out and making publicly available is aggregated information. So minimum cell sizes rolled up to the county level or the state level. There's no identifiability there. If you're a university academic, you can apply to access the microdata. And I understand that there are over a dozen university folks who have done that. But again, it's all done under what you would consider traditional IRB and academic research provisions.
Will it pop up on everyone's screen? Is it on everybody's Facebook feed?
You know, they select a sample of people and mm-hmm. say like, hey, do you want to participate in the survey? So it's an ongoing offer to do it.
Well, Dr. Mostashari, one of the things that keeps us going through these challenging times is there's always some unanticipated advances, right, that come with these great challenges. The acceleration of use of telehealth in primary care and behavioral health has certainly been one of those. But another one is really this possible game changer for primary care and the ability to maybe aggregate real-time data to really do a much better job of watching over our large cohorts of patients who have chronic illness or who have needs for additional prevention and health promotion. A lot of practices have had trouble integrating data like that into their workflow. Do you want to opine a bit on how platforms like the Facebook symptom database could be modified to assist frontline providers, such as primary care providers? You've done a lot of innovation in this area. We'd really be curious about some of the things you're excited about.
Yeah, look, stepping away from the Facebook symptom survey, I think the point is how do we get situational awareness of the greater world mm-hmm. into clinical workflows? That's what you're really talking
yeah.
about. And, well you know, said. for many years, decades, my hope was that electronic health records were going to be those tools for population health, that they were going to provide that visibility, 360-degree visibility into the care of the patient, but also not just the people who are here today,
right,
where you're going to see and you're going to bill a visit for, right. but right. of your entire panel of patients, who should you be worried about?
Right.
What's happening to them out there? When someone goes to the hospital, do you get notified? When mm-hmm. someone leaves the emergency room, do you get a ping in your practice? Do you have workflows for then doing something with that information? If your patient doesn't fill a prescription, do you ever know about it? And do you ever have an opportunity to do something about it? that is the heart of population health. And I don't think electronic health records, despite 5 years of our efforts, are going to be the tools to do that. What we've done at Aledaid, we support 550 practices across 30 states. They're on 90 different electronic health record and practice management systems, but they're using our tool to do population health work. And it's a single cloud-based soft piece of software that does care management, panel management, work lists, and point of care, and now telehealth as well.
Great.
And it's just part of how we're able to get success at reducing hospitalizations. We saved 10,000 hospitalizations last year, $180 million of savings for Medicare alone. And that's the key. The key part of it is providing that information in context for population health purposes. And, you know, we do provide, as part of a small part of that, right, like COVID information for the individuals as well as for the communities, but it's just the tip of the iceberg.
There is ways that we're rethinking, reimagining the delivery of healthcare and leveraging technology, but probably also doing the things that you're doing now, leveraging AI. What do you see the next 5 years looking like in the landscape with, I think, this robust adoption by people of telehealth, but also all of the folks who are coming in and trying to make real inroads on social determinants of health and in other factors that are playing a role in the transformation that's happening now?
2020 has been a pretty horrible year in many ways. Let's look for the bright spots. I'll pick three. One bright spot is just recognizing that healthcare can move darn fast mm-hmm. when it has to, and regulators can move darn fast. I mean, what CMS did on an almost daily basis was extraordinary to help keep practices alive and afloat, and to modify regulations with OIG, with OCR, with the payment side to enable telehealth to happen. And then the response from healthcare providers in 12 days, we went from 100 telehealth visits to 10,000 telehealth visits, right? We stood up 150 practices on telehealth over a weekend. You would have said that's impossible. I mean, we can still sprint when we have to. The second bright spot, I think, was, as you mentioned, this recognition that fee-for-service is actually not reliable and that we do need to, painful as it is, right? Like, we need to think about ways of moving off of you only get paid if someone walks in the door. I hope that in the next 5 years, we will see an embrace of value-based care that's even greater than the trends were before. The third bittersweet recognition and just hard truth of 2020 in the aftermath of George Floyd was that we can't be bystanders. And the fact that we're looking at racial disparities in deaths from COVID, we in our company are looking not only at how are we doing on the various things we're working on, our core initiatives, but also what is the degree of racial disparities in those? And we are committing to move to action to remove those and eliminate those racial disparities. These have been hard times for many of us and for many of our patients, our providers, our communities. But I do think that we have an opportunity to learn and grow from them.
We've been speaking today with Dr. Farzad Mostashari, the founder and CEO of Aledaid and chair of the COVID-19 Symptom Data Challenge. You can learn more about this exciting work by going to symptomchallenge.org, or you can follow Dr. Mostashari on Twitter at Farzad_MD. Farzad, we want to thank you for joining us again today on Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you.
Conversations on Healthcare hosts Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter in a discussion with Dr. Farzad Mostashari. You can follow this and other healthcare topics at chcradio.com. Next on Main Street, a commentary from Mark Trahant.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Basin Electric Power Cooperative, headquartered in Bismarck. a Touchstone Energy cooperative generating and delivering electricity to over 3 million consumers in 9 states, spanning from the Canadian to Mexican border. And by Dr. Julie Peterman Bryant at the Bryant Clinic of Chiropractic and Acupuncture in Bismarck, naturally working with people to feel better, be healthy, and live well.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Alaska and Hawaii were added to the U.S. flag more than 60 years ago. Before that and since, statehood has been debated for Puerto Rico and Washington, D.C. Today, Mark Trahant, the editor of Indian Country Today, offers a commentary about another proposed state for Native Americans.
Recently, Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, a Democrat from New York, told MSNBC that he'd love to make both Washington, D.C. and Puerto Rico states. This could happen should Democrats win the election, especially if there's a sweep of the House, Senate, and White House. The state of Navajo has been an idea that surfaces from time to time, and the idea of an indigenous state has a rich history in the United States as well as around the world. Statehood will not fix the problems facing the Navajo Nation, but it would do two things: add representation in Congress and open up funding. We're talking about 2 U.S. senators and at least 1 member of the House. The federal government has a different formula for how to distribute money to states than it does for tribal governments. So much so that federal dollars are the single largest share of every state budget, averaging about a third of all money coming in. Nearly 1 out of every $5 spent by Congress is shipped to states. Some states do better than others. New Mexico is at the top of the list. The Brookings Institute estimates that the transfer of payments between the federal government and that state reach more than $3,500 per person. If that same formula applied to the Navajo Nation, the total funding would be around $600 million per year. As a comparison, the emergency funding in the Coronavirus Aid, Relief, and Economic Security Act was $714 million, but that was one-time funding source and the most ever spent on Indian country. There is no guarantee that a Navajo state would receive that much, but even if the state with the lowest percentage of federal transfers is used as a base number, it would still exceed $340 million a year. Then, so much of federal spending is based on census data, including poverty levels, so a Navajo state is likely to be on the higher side of that equation. There is an interesting history here. Congress considered the state of Sequoia more than a century ago in what is now eastern Oklahoma. There are also international examples, ranging from Nunavut in Canada to Greenland. There is also the question of representation. The territories of the United States, such as Puerto Rico, Guam, and the Commonwealth of the Northern Mariana Islands, have marginal representation in Congress, a House delegate that can serve in committees but not vote, and even that is not equitable. The delegate that represents the Northern Mariana Islands has a constituency of about 55,000 people, less than a third of the population of the Navajo Nation. A delegate in Congress does not go far enough for former Navajo Attorney General Ethel Branch. She told me that would only be marginally helpful. You need people in Congress that can introduce legislation and carry that to the finish line. I'm Mark Trahant.
You can follow Mark Trahant and Native Issues at IndianCountryToday.com. Coming up on Main Street, a new book about the Fargo Fire of 1893. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. Minnesota has passed the 300 mark in traffic deaths for 2020. That's weeks earlier than last year. Minnesota State Patrol Chief Colonel Matt Langer says the numbers are due in large part to the usual factors, including impaired and distracted driving and a lack of seatbelt use. But he says there has also been a spike in speeding, and particularly in drivers topping 100 miles an hour. Langer says lighter traffic due to the pandemic has been part of the reason. However, he said the patrol was not losing focus on motorists as it responded to civil unrest.
Although the state patrol has been doing a lot of things this year as a result of the challenges that have faced our state and our nation, we remain focused on our traffic safety mission. It's why we came into existence in the first place.
The state says while motor vehicle fatalities have remained stable, there have been increases in motorcycle and pedestrian-related deaths. UND held a ceremonial cutting of the ribbon for its new steam plant today. The plant replaces a 100-year-old facility that used coal to produce steam heat for the campus and for some off-campus customers. The new plant was built through a public-private partnership in that Johnson Controls built the plant and will manage it. The new plant uses natural gas and will save money. Grand Forks Republican State Senator Ray Holmberg chairs the Senate Appropriations Committee and was one of the speakers at the event.
Thank you, UND, and its private partners for thinking outside of the box and supporting the concept that state resources should be focused on the classroom and research, not a project the private sector was willing to fund, especially since it is saving the state of North Dakota and ultimately the taxpayers from footing the bill.
The total cost of the project was $90 million. And a name change is in the works for Woodrow Wilson High School in Fargo. The school board voted unanimously to remove the former president's name because of his racist past. Public pressure for the change led the school board to set up a committee to examine the issue that included developing a renaming policy, which had not existed. Before last night's vote, school board member Jim Johnson spoke about the impact the name change will have on Woodrow Wilson students and staff attending the alternative school.
So the name Woodrow Wilson means one thing to people that have researched and spoken to us both for and against, and I understand all of that. It means something totally different to the students and the staff that are in that building. They know who they are. They know their identity. And they are perfectly comfortable changing the name of their school.
The renaming process will begin immediately for the school board. The name change will take effect at the beginning of the 2021-2022 school year. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
The Bismarck Mandan Symphony Orchestra is for people who treasure music and the arts. Hi, I'm Maestro Beverly Everett. We're performing our full concert schedule this season. Details are subject to change. Don't miss Fate and Fantasy, October 17th, featuring our 2019 Young Artist winners and a celebration of Beethoven's 250th birthday. For up-to-date concert and ticket information, visit bismarckmandansymphony.org.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, joined now by Danielle Tigan. She's the author of a new book about an important piece of history. The Fargo Fire of 1893 is the title of the book. It's going to be released by the Arcadia Publishing and the History Press next Monday. That is October 19th. Danielle, thanks for joining us today.
Well, thank you for inviting me, Doug. I appreciate you having me on.
Why did you write the book?
Why did I write the book? Well, actually, because nobody else had written a book about the Fargo Fire of 1893. It's one of the most important events in Fargo's history. You know, one of its most crucial at the beginning of the city's, you know, early history. And I was really surprised that no one had yet written a book about it and kind of put together all these really great sources and these great, you know, pieces of information from different, you know, historians or different outlets in Fargo-Moorhead. And I was really surprised to find out there wasn't a book about it. So I decided, well, I guess I'll write a book about it then.
Well, I've certainly heard about it. It's been written in other histories of the city, but just as a chapter or something like that, because it was so important.
Right.
You were on our show a few years ago for your first book, Hidden History of Fargo. That was also published by Arcadia Publishing and the History Press. So how did this get started? Do you pitch a book to Arcadia? Is that how you do it?
Yep. And actually, when I pitched that book, I wanted to include an entire chapter about the Fargo Fire of 1893 in that book. And my project editor told me, you know, you can certainly mention the fire and, you know, have some information about it. But he said standalone disaster titles, he called them, actually do really well as their own book. And so I kind of thought, well, I'm sure someone has written a book before. So I included, you know, in that information about the fire in the Hidden History of Fargo book, but I just assumed someone else had already written that. And so after Hidden History of Fargo came out and I started talking to more and more people, you know, different presentations and things that I was doing in the community, and they would talk about the fire specifically. And it was actually Steve Hubbard, who is a librarian at the main library downtown. I was talking with him after a presentation, and he said, he had interviewed John Hanaher, who was 13 years old at the time of the fire. And he had interviewed John, you know, I think 30 years prior while he was in college, and interviewed him about the fire. And he said, yeah, that transcript of that interview is actually at the archives if you're ever interested. And I went, yeah, I'm interested in knowing what did John Hanaher have to say about, you know, being in that fire or the experience of it and stuff. And so when I started looking around and finding more sources like that, and like you said, they've, you know, the fire has been talked about in a lot of different outlets, but once I started realizing there were a lot of pieces of information about the fire, but nothing had been put together in kind of a beginning to end narrative, I thought, I think we need this. I think Fargo needs this, you know, for its history, to have someone start from, you know, what was going on in the city to what happened that day, and then what happened obviously after that day in 1893. So that was kind of where it all came to. And then I pitched it to my project editor and said, hey, no one's written a book about this before, and I think it might do well. What do you think? And they thought it was a great idea. So here we are.
Well, there are some familiar names in the book. You mentioned one of them, John Hanaher. I grew up with a lot of Hanahers in Moorhead.
Right.
Set the scene for us. Fargo and Moorhead had been around for about 20 years when this fire hits. What was Fargo like in 1893?
Right. So Fargo actually had about 6,000 people living there at the time. You know, it's kind of hard to imagine now Fargo ever being that small, but it really, you know, it was growing, but it hadn't quite boomed yet. That boom would come a little bit later. You know, but there was a really great thriving business district. Hundreds of businesses were operating in downtown right along Broadway and Main. At the time it was Front Street. So if you know anything about Fargo's history, you know that that's changed, but Front Street and Broadway were the main heart of the city, the business district, and that's what was going on. You know, and there was a lot of growth. There were a lot of different manufacturers. There were a lot of ag implements actually in Fargo at the time of the fire. There were businesses, you know, doctors, banks, lawyers. There was just a lot of business happening there. And it was really a great place for people to come and visit, you know, and it was still much like what we associate now. It was a town that drew people from the area. So a lot of visitors, you know, were coming to see things. And actually it was interesting. I don't think I'd ever known this about the fire, but there was going to be the State Firemen Association meeting the following weekend after the fire. So the fire happened on a Wednesday. There was going to be a big meeting, but part of that meeting was also going to be a firefighters tournament. This was very popular at that time for these different firefighting companies. And so the community was really excited about this, because that turned into a really big community event for people to come out and cheer for their fire boys, they called them.
Yeah, I've done some history projects about Fargo and Moorhead too, and I'm old enough to remember when Front Street still existed. It was a shanty town down by the river, and I think that was back in the early days, around the time of the fire. That was Fargo in the woods, and then there was Fargo on the prairie, which is where people with enough cash to build a home could live. Tell us about the social life. The North Dakota Agricultural College had just been founded. It was only a couple of years old when the fire
hit.
So set the social scene for us.
Sure. Many of the people who were kind of the big wigs or the big names in the community, their social life really revolved around, you know, getting their businesses, getting those things up and running. But then they spent time, you know, visiting each other's homes. You know, a lot of the homes that you might see along 8th Street in Fargo, they have big entertainment areas, because that's what people did socially, is they would go and visit one another, might have big dinners. They might even have dances. I know Matilda Roberts' home, the fourth floor of her home was designed specifically to be a ballroom so that they could have these big parties and do that. You know, in the social scene, there were lots of different restaurants in the Fargo Moorhead area at the time too, you know, whether it was right along Front Street, there were several on Broadway and some of those off streets too. But yeah. And it was interesting too. I did not realize this until I was researching that day in June was actually the last day of school for the Fargo public school children. So those kids were probably really excited for the start of summer and thinking about all the great things that were going to be happening that summer. And again, not realizing how crazy that afternoon after they got out of school, things were really going to get when the fire started.
So what happened on that day in June, 1893?
Right. So that Wednesday, so the fire started in the afternoon, and it was interesting because I thought it was important to understand the weather, because we always hear stories about how hot it was that day. And it did get up to 88 degrees. When I went back to Daryl Richardson to get some historical weather data, the high that day was 88. So by the time the fire started, it was, you know, near 90 degrees. But I also think it's important for people to know that there hadn't been a lot of rain in the preceding, I think it was months, actually. When I looked, when I talked to John Wheeler, he told me about the precip amounts. And he said, you know, there was no rain from basically April until, I mean, this was June, you know? So he said this, you have to think about how dusty and how hot that day must have been for people. And so that morning, you know, as people are going about their day, getting their businesses up and running, kids are finishing up school. The afternoon was pretty hot and dusty. There was about a 30 mile an hour wind, and we hear about that too. But you also think about how that kept people maybe indoors or kept them in the businesses too, not really going outside to see what was happening. So around 2 o'clock, the story, there's actually some dispute about how the fire itself started, but the most commonly described start of the fire is that either Lily Hersman, who was working at a dry goods store on Front Street at 512 Front Street, she may have thrown some ashes out the back door into the alley behind the stores, or there was a story that maybe there was some cardboard burning behind the store and the fire got out of hand. But basically, one of those stories has to do with either some smoldering ashes or some burning cardboard. And because it was just so windy and everything was so, so dry, the ground, these buildings, everything was so dry that it basically ignited everything, you know, near those embers. And so the fire started right at 512, and it didn't take long for that fire to quickly spread throughout the rest of that block. It was interesting that not every single building on that block, not every business was a complete loss, but several of them were, like the Hersman store and a couple of other neighboring stores. But probably what also didn't help immediately when that fire started is that there was a gun shop nearby. Schofield's Gun Shop was just two stores down from where the fire started, and it was full of gunpowder. And it exploded. So you think about, you know, a fire already in a dry place and it has plenty of tinder from all of these wooden buildings. And then all of a sudden there's an explosion that just adds literally more fuel to that fire. And it just, it took off from there. And at the time, the fire alarm system, you know, in Fargo had to do with all of these strategically placed fire alarm boxes. And actually a fire alarm box just a few stores down the fire started, and a volunteer firefighter who was in the area realized what was happening, and he ran into that store. It was Sundberg's jewelry store, and he ran in to get the key to open the box to sound the alarm, but the clerk couldn't find the key, so they couldn't get into that box. So then they were running around trying to find this key. They ended up, he found a police officer another block down. I think he was a block west of where the fire started, and so they finally did get an alarm sounded, but because of that delay in finding the key and then the delay in finding someone else who could set the alarm, they did lose a lot of really valuable time in trying to keep that fire contained, because by the time all of this happened, that fire was already raging and it was on its way north on Broadway, actually.
Danielle Tigan is the author of the new book, The Fargo Fire of 1893. You mentioned the volunteer firefighters. How did they fight a fire back in the late 19th century?
Well, they didn't have really great modern firefighting equipment, but they did have some hose carts. So at the time, the city had started investing actually in some firefighting equipment in the 1880s. And so that was when they'd had a couple of fires and they realized, hey, we need more than just buckets, because literally up until that point, they had a bucket brigade. That's where the name comes from, is that volunteers were just picking up buckets of water and throwing it on a fire and trying to do something with that. And it didn't take very many fires for the community of Fargo to realize we need something bigger and better. And so at the time they had hose carts, which were just, it was what it sounds like. It was a pulled cart, they have huge wheels, and they have the hose that's rolled up on it. And so then they can take those out of the building and take them, you know, wheel them to where they need to go. They had a hand-drawn cart, but they also had horse-drawn carts at the time. So Fargo had, I believe they had three different carts, one hose cart and two horses. But unfortunately, one of the horse-drawn carts was actually being used at the time to wet down those dusty streets. And unfortunately, the firefighter who was doing it was at the north end of Broadway near the Great Northern Railway Depot when the alarm sounded. So he was already, that far away from the southern edge of Broadway where this fire started. So that was another delay. And actually, there was a firehouse where they stored some of these carts just across the street, literally across the street on Front Street from where the fire started. But again, there was that confusion of how to, you know, where to get the fire and how to get those alarms sounded, that they lost a lot of time. And unfortunately, actually, because of the trajectory of the fire and where it went, that building with all of the equipment where those hose carts were being kept actually went up in flames pretty early in the fire too. So then they couldn't even use that equipment. They did have the firefighters. There were three different firefighting companies at the time, and they all kept some equipment at the main fire station. They called it the central station. It's actually on the corner of NP and Roberts where the current fire department is. I didn't know that either until I started researching it. So if you go and stand in front of the current Fargo Fire Department, you're actually looking at the original location of the central fire station. And that's where they had some of those. They had another horse-drawn carriage or another horse-drawn hose cart there too. So they were able to get that out and start pumping some water. They had a pretty rudimentary water pumping system put in place at the time, which obviously gave them some water, and they were pumping it from a station just south of Island Park. So it was pretty close to where the fire started. But again, all of those delays in getting things hooked up, getting the water going, you know, it was valuable seconds that they were losing, which obviously didn't help with keeping that fire contained because they couldn't. They honestly couldn't contain it.
This becomes an inferno. How big did it get? How much of Fargo did it destroy?
Right. How much? So, I mean, its trajectory as far as the path that it took, you know, going, it stayed pretty contained to those couple of blocks on Front Street, but then it wiped out so much of Broadway up to about 4th, I believe it's 4th Avenue. But when it was all said and done and they figured out how many businesses and just what the damage was, it was 30 city blocks. So if you think about, you know, downtown Fargo now, 30 city blocks is still a significant amount of land to just go up in flames. So 30 city blocks, 210 businesses were lost in that fire and 140 residences. So we think now, well, but there's not, you know, now we have condos and things like that downtown. But at the time, this was also a surprising little piece of information I hadn't thought about, is that at the time, you know, if you're a lawyer and you're practicing in downtown Fargo, you're probably also living in the second floor of your two-story building. And so people don't always realize that these people not only lost their business, their livelihoods, but they likely lost a home as well. And so that's where that number, the 140 residences, comes in. You have to think about all of those upper level homes that people actually lived in, and then they worked in the first floor. So that put 2,000 people out on the streets. They didn't have a place to go by the time that fire finally ended. They added up that it was over 6.5 miles of wooden sidewalks that had burned up, 150 miles of telephone poles. There was an overhead telephone system in Fargo at the time. And all told, it was $3 million in losses. And $3 million in 1893, I mean, you think about what that is, that's a significant sum right now. But in 1893, that likely felt catastrophic for most of those Fargo residents.
Well, that was a double whammy in a way. There was a fire and there was this national depression, which didn't leave Fargo untouched. Did the fire burn out or was it put out?
You know, it actually burned itself out. You know, they set the alarms off and got the Fargo fire companies going as quickly as they could. Morehead obviously came over. They sounded the alarm to have some area. So I know Grand Forks was on its way. Castleton came down. Wahpeton was en route. And they helped, but none of them could contain the fire enough, like that they put it out. It ended up just burning itself out by that evening. By about 7 o'clock, the fire, it burned itself out, which was obviously a stroke of luck that it didn't just keep burning and burning through buildings. But that was still a significant amount of damage done in just, you know, a few hours worth of time.
How did the community react to the tragedy? You mentioned all of these businesses gone, all these people displaced, lost their homes. Did people leave? What happened?
No, actually, it was kind of inspiring to read all of these different newspaper articles in the days following the fire, how basically everybody, not just in Fargo, Morehead, but everybody in the region really rallied around Fargo and said, you know what, we're going to do better. We're going to come back from this stronger. We're not going to let this beat us, and we are going to overcome this. And, you know, you think maybe that's just a little bit of oh, it's just some nice words, but they really did. I mean, the next day the city council was meeting to say, okay, what do we need to do? What can we put in place? What are some temporary measures we can do to keep businesses here to make sure that we're getting these businesses rebuilt? You know, city ordinances that they needed to put in place to make the community safer and better for these businesses too. But I mean, it was really interesting to read. So Alex Stern, you've probably heard that name,
yes.
Obviously associated with Fargo's history. He was a huge, you know, business advocate and arts advocate at the time. And he immediately said, I'm rebuilding right now. I've already put an order in for, you know, bricks and for stone. I'm going to employ hundreds of men if I need to, but I'm rebuilding this. And he did. I mean, his early action was really kind of pointed to as sort of the inspiration for a lot of other business owners too. And, you know, lots of people said, we're not going to let this beat us. And they didn't. They really didn't. They set to work and they started rebuilding. And even by the next year, there were 246 new buildings that had been built in downtown Fargo in just that 1 year since the fire. So 246 buildings, you know, were there and ready to do business and keep that community and keep the economy of that community running.
Did they add some infrastructure like fire hydrants or anything like that?
You know, they didn't have fire hydrants at the time, but they had these water pumping stations. And so actually one of the improvements that they did that the city wanted to enact was they did want a better system, a water system. And so they put in a new pumping station actually that had more water stations throughout the city. At the time of the fire, they didn't have that many. And so that was also, the water pressure wasn't great when they did get, you know, these hoses hooked up. And so that was one of the improvements, is making sure that there were more stations that they could hook it up to a larger station too, because then that added the water pressure, the increased water pressure for when fires did happen. They also connected it to their fire alarm station, directly to it, so that before it wasn't, but they wanted it connected right to the alarm system, so that as soon as a fire alarm rang, that system was ready to go and they could just hook up where they needed to and get going, you know, getting that fire out. The city itself put together inspection ordinances so that buildings that, you know, weren't being kept up to fire code, all of a sudden now they could face some fines, which before the fire, they hadn't really worried about that. They didn't allow wooden sidewalks anymore. They wanted buildings made of brick and stone, you know, that was going to be more durable if another fire happened. And so there really was a lot that the city did that, you know, that everyone wanted to see Fargo come back bigger and better than before.
Well, the book is called The Fargo Fire of 1893. It's published by Arcadia Publishing and the History Press. It tells a fascinating piece of history about where we live and, frankly, something that's happened in lots of communities over the centuries. But certainly, remember the Chicago fire and Mrs. O'Leary's cow, and now we've got the Herzman dry goods store being implicated in this fire. But the book by Danielle Tigan also has appendices with lots of information, like three publications in the city at the time, the Fargo Daily Forum, the Fargo Republican, and the Weekly Dakota. So it's full of photographs and rich history, and it's a lot of detail about something that's really fascinating to read about. Thank you for spending some time with us, Danielle.
Absolutely. Well, thank you again for having me. I really appreciate being able to talk about this. It's very important, and we appreciate being able to tell this piece of important history.
Coming up, another piece of history, Dakota Date Book.
On Prairie Public Primetime TV tonight.
We've been taking the environment for granted for a long time.
Nature is fundamentally essential to our future existence.
Explore the vital connection between humans and nature.
In this new era, we can restore ecosystems.
And the people making positive change for the planet.
We need nature to survive on this planet.
Discover new solutions.
I can't think of a more inspirational story
for a better future.
Watch The Age of Nature tonight at 9 Central, 8 o'clock Mountain on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for October 14th. On this date in 1912, a man named John Schrank shot Theodore Roosevelt in the chest with a .32 caliber gun. Roosevelt was on the campaign trail as he sought to return to the presidency. The shooting took place in front of a hotel in Milwaukee as Roosevelt left to deliver a speech. As Roosevelt waved his hat to the crowd, Schrank raised his gun between two men and fired. A newspaper report of the incident said, quote, "Colonel Roosevelt barely moved as the shot was fired. Before the crowd knew what had happened, E.E. Martin, who is 6 feet tall and a former football player, had landed squarely on the assassin's shoulders and borne him to the ground. T.R., meanwhile, put his hand to his mouth and determined that since there was no blood, his lung hadn't been pierced. Believing he wasn't in any danger, T.R. insisted on proceeding to the Milwaukee Auditorium to give his speech. With his white vest soaked in blood, Roosevelt faced his throng of supporters and calmly said, "I have just been shot." He drew the bloodied speech from his breast pocket, held up the bullet-pierced pages, and said, "But it takes more than that to kill a bull moose. The bullet is in me now, so that I cannot make a very long speech. But I want you to understand that I am ahead of the game anyway. No man has had a happier life than I have led, a happier life in every way." Minutes later, Roosevelt collapsed and was rushed to the hospital. 3 weeks later, T.R.'s cousin, Nicholas Roosevelt, visited him at Sagamore and later recorded this in his diary. "In one of the drawers of T.R.'s bureau, his son found a wad of paper and suddenly exclaimed, 'Oh, there's the speech!' And delving deeper, brought out a spectacle case with a bullet hole through it. The speech, done on heavy paper folded double, was pierced and badly torn. Through the spectacle case was a round hole about the size of a finger. Thankfully, Roosevelt recovered and went back on the campaign trail, but his time in the sun was pretty much over, and a third term was not to be his. North Dakota's Rough Rider Award is so named in reflection of the state's relationship to the 26th president. Today's Dakota Datebook, written by Mary Helm. I'm Bill Thomas.
Millions of people across this country are struggling to collect unemployment benefits.
It's so hard to just prove that you exist.
Fraudulent claims made during the pandemic have led to a tougher review process and long delays to people getting paid. But are the added security measures even working?
Sadly, they haven't been protecting the system from much fraud.
On the next Morning Edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Thank you for joining us today for Main Street. As we broadcast, we stream at prairiepublic.org, and after the broadcast, you can find any Main Street show at prairiepublic.org. Thursday on our show, we'll hear from Michelle Comer. She's the outgoing commissioner of the North Dakota Department of Commerce. She'll talk about her new venture and her time in the public sector dealing with the pandemic. And Sue Balcom will drop by for our weekly Main Street Eats conversation. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Thursday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.